I see that Latino voters are growing in their share of numbers, but I still see us being under attack. And obviously, this president has made that a point of his presidency, right, is to attack immigrants, to attack Mexico, and to attack the Mexican-American community in this country. Building power through participation feels just like a really important lever to building power for our community.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. In this episode, I talked to Stephanie Valencia about several things highly relevant to the subject of this podcast. Stephanie's been working with previous guests of the show, Dimitri Melhorn and Tamer Mokhtar from Investing in Us, a group that funds organizations resisting Trump and Trumpism using money from Reid Hoffman and others. Stephanie brought a great deal of political experience to that effort, including campaigning and her work in the White House and the Department of Commerce during the Obama administration. Stephanie has now founded her own enterprise called Ekis to help organize the Latino community to participate at higher levels. So we talked about her career and that work that she's up to. Stephanie is another terrific stop in my journey to understand entrepreneurship and our efforts to beat Trump. So with that as background, a quick word from our sponsor, then my interview with Stephanie Valencia with Ekis.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, Stephanie.
Hi.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
Do you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Yep. So I was born in New Mexico. I am a 10th generation New Mexican, meaning my family was in New Mexico and all parts of New Mexico since before it was part of the United States.
That's a lot of generations.
That's a lot of generations. My great-great-grandfather fought alongside Geronimo in the Apache Indian tribe. New Mexico is uniquely positioned in this place where, you know, the U.S.-Mexico War took place in the late 1800s, early 1900s, as the U.S. and Mexico were fighting for the land of the West, right? And so my family were directly affected by that. And as many people like to say in New Mexico, we didn't cross the border. The border crossed us. As my mom used to tell me, you know, our family was here before Manifest Destiny was even a concept. And we just have a very deep history there. I grew up on the U.S.-Mexico border, right near El Paso, Texas, and got involved in politics as a young child. My dad was an elected official, and so politics is kind of in my blood.
What level was he?
He was a city councilman. He was the youngest ever elected at the time, city councilor in Las Cruces. As I like to say, I was block walking and cutting turf like the old way when you used to have to like go to the county assessor's office and get the maps yourself and then literally cut turf. It has always been a part of who I am. When I went to college, I went to Boston College, spent a lot of time just kind of thinking about what does that mean to kind of my career, and came to Washington, D.C. after having lived in Central America for a little while, where I saw really the disparity of wealth in Latin America, and then came to D.C. and back to Boston for the 2004 Democratic National Convention where I worked, where I saw a very famous speech that Barack Obama delivered in 2004.
What was your role at that convention?
I was actually the assistant to the general counsel of the Democratic National Convention and spent a lot of time thinking about where were the free speech, like protest areas, like lots of negotiations with the city of Boston around what areas we had access to and what areas like we had to create space for free speech protesting and all of that around the convention.
Who was the general counsel?
Her name was Cindy Lott, and at the time, Joe Sandler, who's a big lawyer here in D.C.
was on the show earlier.
Yeah, he was the convention's like official, you know, outside counsel, and Cindy was the official general counsel. And that was my first real job in politics, and worked on the Kerry campaign in 2004 in New Mexico after that. In 2006, worked on a congressional race in New Mexico again, where we lost by just under 1,000 votes in a recount. I had the congressional district 1, which is now a very blue congressional district, but wasn't always. Heather Wilson held that seat for a really long time, Republican. Then jumped on the Obama campaign in 2008. I had worked on Capitol Hill for a while and would sneak away like for weekends to primary states in New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada. I was working for Ken Salazar at the time. And if you recall, the Democratic National Convention was in Denver in 2008. So Ken was very reluctant to endorse either Hillary or Obama because he knew them both really well and wanted the primary process to play out. So ultimately, I ended up leaving his office in 2007 or early 2008 to go be Deputy Latino Vote Director on the Obama campaign. I also worked in 2006 in the House Democratic Caucus for Rahm Emanuel when we won the House back last, and we had a very different, kind of a similar situation of where we are in 2018, where we had a couple dozen or a few dozen new members, and my job was one of a couple people to do member services and make sure those members were leveraging and using every tool that they had in their toolbox, and basically teaching them to be members of Congress, teaching them how to use the franked mail system, teaching them how to do Congress on your corner. And I looked back at that list a couple of weeks ago and realized that there, I think, is only one person from that original class of 2006 freshmen who are still in Congress today. That was the class of Gabby Giffords, Heath Shuler, and a number of other kind of super centrist.
They average about 12 years, so that makes sense.
Exactly. So 2008 Obama campaign traveled around in New Mexico, Nevada, Colorado, and Florida, where there were sizable Latino populations. We're running Camp Obamas, helping to train new Latino organizers in these places and build out in our Latino strategy. And at the time, President Obama in 2008 had gotten the largest share of the Latino vote of any candidate in history. So I was very proud of that. And then went to work on in the White House, where my job was in the Office of Public Engagement. And my job was to basically help build energy for the president's policy agenda on the official side. I worked on Latino engagement and immigration issues. And obviously, you know, both of those were real big challenges. On the plus side, I got to work on the confirmation of the first Latina Supreme Court Justice, Sonia Sotomayor, and played a very important role in that confirmation process. On the other hand, you know, we had struggles in passing immigration reform and passing the DREAM Act, passing a broader comprehensive immigration reform package. And so I got so many lessons learned about that time and so many things I don't think we realized we were going to encounter when he came into office, both about that moment in time and I think also just the ability or the ease in which we thought we could pass immigration reform. And then in 2014, I went to work for Penny Pritzker, who was Secretary of Commerce at the time. She had just been confirmed as Secretary of Commerce and was building out her leadership team to help implement her agenda. And so I got to spend a lot of time traveling the world with her in Mexico, Canada, Asia, to advocate for U.S. industry around the world. So I've got a very different perspective than what I was accustomed to, kind of seeing the business side and industry first side of things and the role that government plays there. To Penny's credit, really tried to up-level, I think, the Department of Commerce's ability to advocate on behalf of like the tech and innovation industries, because up until that point, they were not really part of, and kind of their distinct and unique needs weren't really well understood. I then left Penny and went to go work at Google for a couple of years, where my job was to work with progressives and, you know, a wide swath of third party groups on the tech policy agenda. And so I was there, took a small sabbatical at the end of 2016 to join the Clinton-Kane pre-transition effort, which was hyper kind of secret. We weren't allowed to take any outside meetings. This was the how do we prepare if she won. The federal government actually allocated resources for both nominees to have these pre-transition efforts to prepare. So we were thinking through, you know, how we were going to build out her transition effort, how she was going to spend her 85 days between the election and taking office. obviously, that didn't happen. And there were lots of sad reasons that I've reflected on of why diversity, especially being one of them, she was going to have the most diverse cabinet. She really was pushing us hard to ensure that the people who were elected her were actually reflected on her transition team and in government. So to me, that is one of the little talked about sad implications of why she lost.
That is terrible.
Yeah. So after that, I came back to Google and I just didn't feel like I could still be at a place like Google with Trump being president. And so I decided to leave and became one of a set of advisors to Reid Hoffman and a number of people in Silicon Valley who were trying to disrupt and evolve the election and political space through a number of different levers and kind of thinking big and audaciously about some of that work. But overall, I'd say kind of my life and career trajectory, that was a long riff, but has really been focused on Latino political empowerment, innovation and technology, and also building campaigns to build energy around key legislation or key moments. You know, I'm kind of at a point in time now in my career where I'm trying to figure out where I can bring all of those threads together to beat Donald Trump.
That's a rich and wonderful biography for someone who looks as young as you do.
I dye my hair.
And we have a lot to talk about. Maybe we can start a little bit, because of the nature of my podcast, by talking about what you did working with Reid Hoffman and others. I've had some other guests from that operation. How did you get hooked up with that?
So as you kind of heard from my bio, I come from a very traditional campaign and institutional background. I've worked on campaigns and I've seen it kind of from that side of things. And then I've also had the opportunity to be at Google where there was a lot of disruptive thinking about the way things are or the way things could be. Back right after, I think it was around 2016, I saw an initiative that Reid had funded called What the Hell or something like that. It was like a card game or something like that, or a way that people could vote on the issues they wanted their members of Congress to like take on. And I just remember being super puzzled by it and really thinking, this is what Silicon Valley billionaires are thinking about. And just thinking that there was like some disconnection from reality in some ways that I felt we needed to bridge. And ironically, after the 2017 Virginia elections, at the end of 2018, I was connected with Reid and his team and sat down at a coffee shop. And this is kind of how Silicon Valley in some ways, you know, does its hiring. Dimitri Melhorn, who's one of his chief political advisors, sat down with me, heard my bio for about 10 minutes and said, okay, well, are you ready to leave Google to do this job? And I said, I don't know anything about what you're doing. Tell me a little bit more. Can we have like a follow-up conversation? But I knew in that moment that there was a really important opportunity to help shape and be at the table to shape the dialogue and conversation and bridge, you know, it's like I had this feet in two worlds of being in politics and kind of the traditional spaces and being in the tech world. And so I kind of saw myself as a translator to both of those folks. I have friends, you know, who run the DNC, the DTRIP, and the institutional orgs. And they're like, what are these Silicon Valley people think they can do here? And on the other hand, I'm with the Silicon Valley folks who are saying, why aren't they doing better? Why aren't they being more innovative? My job in some ways became basically as his political director that I started in early 2018, became that translator between these two universes and worlds. And it was a fascinating opportunity to be able to see the possibility of what could be created and the kind of creativity that could be unleashed when you invest in tech tools in a real way. And then also saw the painful gaps that exist in terms of the capacity for a lot of institutional organizations to be able to take on those tools. Famously, you know, we would kind of say you can build a bunch of fancy tools, but unless people actually know how to use them, they're just tools in a toolbox. Part of my job was, again, to start to bridge some of those gaps and help the institutional folks understand what the possibility of what some of these tools were, but at the same time ensure that like the people who were building the tools and thinking about the investment in the tools weren't just thinking about them as tools, but thinking about who were the people that actually could use them in the end.
Can we make that more concrete by talking about some of those tools?
If 2018 was the election of relational organizing, or as I like to say, rediscovering relational organizing and applying tech tools to relational organizing, I think the principle of relational organizing, which is people to people, you're leveraging your personal social network, whether it's your family and friends, to getting people to take an action, is a powerful tool. And given where people exist today, which is on social media, there were 4 or 5 new relational organizing tech tools that tried to solve that problem by looking at the phone numbers in your phone and crossing that with the voter file to see who had registered to vote and who had voted recently so you could do that personal outreach, to using Facebook like the team app does, to MyRVP, which is actually just looking through your phone, writing down a bunch of phone numbers, somebody going and cross-checking that with the voter file, them coming back in. There were lots of different methods to go out and do that. If that wasn't a core part of an organization's field program and like what they were actually asking volunteers to do or their staff to do, it was just a tool. Like if it wasn't like kind of built into the number of hours that people came in, and in addition to going and knocking doors or making calls, they were spending an hour using the team app, sharing content, right? And I think the challenge that I saw was that we went and connected people to a bunch of tools, but then it wasn't necessarily.
So are you saying you funded these tools?
So we would fund a number of the tools themselves so that they could build and be better tools. But then we also funded the use of some of those tools by organizations on the ground. So I like to use the example of the Hispanic Federation in Central Florida. We funded them to use the team app, right? But by the time we were able to get them to actually use the team app, it was really late in the cycle. And so there was limited ability for them to actually integrate that into their program, for them to be able to use it at the scale and possibility that I think that they could use it at. And I think using an app like the Team app, for example, which shares content from Facebook and allows people to kind of cross-reference who was sharing and interacting with your content back on the voter file, using that off-cycle around issues is also really important for an organization like the Hispanic Federation in Central Florida, who's trying to communicate with Puerto Rican voters and Puerto Rican citizens in Central Florida. Being able to talk to them in the off cycle and continue to build their list and identify where their social networks are in service of where the election, you know, where that will be helpful and powerful in the election in 2020 is of great value. So now that we have more runway, there's more opportunity to kind of sit with them and say, how can this fit into your issue organizing? How can this fit into the work that you're going to be doing in 2019? At the height of the cycle, not everybody was prepared to integrate a tool like that into their program.
The DCCC used that, and I interviewed the founders of Team, and they indicated there was a variety of levels of adoption. I guess that's true across a variety of technologies.
That exemplifies the capacity gap that often exists with certain groups too, right? Like the DCCC had so many more resources, much more ability to, and I give Dan and Aaron and the entire leadership team and Ben Ray Lujan the entire, not just because he's New Mexican and I've known him for my entire life, but they were really trying to integrate the many tech tools, whether it's Mobilize America around volunteer recruitment, the team app, or any number of other pieces to try to up-level the work that they were doing at the DTRIP and expand their capacity, right?
I know that Reed and you guys invested a lot of money. What have you taken from that experience?
On the tech side, I think it is still really hard to understand the true impact of what these tech tools are, for good or for bad. What I mean by when I say that is that, you know, the Analyst Institute is kind of the gold standard for measuring impact of any particular program in progressive politics. And if you get the Analyst Institute gold seal of approval, that means a certain thing. If it's kind of inconclusive or didn't work, whatever, right? Like it means a lot of different things. I would just say, I think it's hard to fully measure, given the changing nature of how the platforms are working, the changing nature of just how these tools work, like that it's hard to always measure the impact of these programs. And it could be having a better impact or it could be having less of an impact. My point is, I just don't know that we are measuring the impact of some of these tools in the right way.
Political scientists have trouble showing impact of campaigns in general.
The kind of core areas that we were invested in, one was around data and building better data infrastructure. Two is about distribution of information. Three was about Trump accountability. And four is around changing the culture of voting. And that last bucket is what I would argue in some ways one of the most important pieces of what we need in our country for our democracy is changing the culture of voting, right? And the example I like to use is that on the island of Puerto Rico, Puerto Ricans vote at a rate of like 85%. Election day is a holiday. I mean, the entire structure of the politics in Puerto Rico is another one because it's based on the status of the island, and people feel very, very passionately about that. But the way I understand it, people from jail can vote. Like, they're just, it's a different culture. There's a celebratory culture. There are caravans, there's music, there's food. And when Puerto Ricans from the island come to the mainland, to Central Florida, Pennsylvania, New York, they're voting at the inverse, right? Like at 20%, 30%. And so the question is, why does that change? And that is endemic, I think, of most Americans, right? Of the entire American electors. Like, why are we not voting at levels of 80, 90% in this country? And so how do we change that? Like, when you actually go vote, it sometimes feels really scary. It feels more like a funeral than a party, right? And so, like, how do you fundamentally change the experience when you show up to go vote?
It's like going to a library.
There is no celebratory nature to this, like, very important experience for our democracy.
And so you guys invested some in trying to change that?
Parties at the polls. And then there are fundamental, like, democracy reforms that need to shift and change so that people don't feel burdened by the process. So same day voter registration, automatic voter registration, better tools and, for online voter registration and making the process easier while still making sure that we have checks in place to know who's actually eligible to vote.
Are you still part of that investing group?
I'm still giving them some portion of my brain to think about what are the most important levers, where are the most important places that Reed should be investing in and his colleagues should be investing in for 2020 that will increase our ability and chances to beat Donald Trump. We had kind of used 2018 as a real important testing opportunity to look at the things that we felt really strongly about that have been tested in 2017 to say what worked and what didn't. And he's pretty committed still to those key categories I mentioned that he was committed to in 2018. And we kind of know the states that are going to be in play in 2020. So that gave me some room to think about where is there white space of a problem I wanted to go tackle. And that kind of teed up the opportunity of the bringing together innovation with the Latino vote. Earlier this year, began to put my head together with a couple former colleagues to say, what are the kind of key issues that we are struggling and facing in massively increasing Latinx voter turnout? Latinos are going to play an outsized role in the country in very key states for 2020, but in the country heading into 2022 and beyond, just given how quickly the electorate's growing.
What exactly are you doing then to try to increase Latinx turnout?
So we are launching a new entity called EQIS, E-Q-I-S, as in the letter X in Spanish, as in the X in Latinx. I really view the Latino community and Latino voters as the X factor in politics and society. The Latino community is rapidly growing in this country, and we have a very, I think, unique set of questions we have to be asking ourselves about how do we organize the Latino community to participate at greater levels, quite frankly, to build more power, right? And I think it's more complicated for the Latino community because there are more nuances about identity. Latinos are probably like the most intersectional ethnic group in this country because we are Black and we are white. We speak Spanish, we don't speak Spanish. We come from 20 different countries, and some of us have been here, like my family, for 10 generations, and some people came yesterday. And so it is such a disparate and different group of people, very, very diverse in all parts of this country. And if you think about like the population growth of the Latino community, think about it as an iceberg. The median age of Latinos in this country is 28 years old. And the fastest growing part of the Latino population are Latinos under five years old. And most of those people who are under five are actually native born. They are not immigrants. And so there is a more complicated, nuanced way to talk about identity and to understand the Latino electorate. The problem that we kind of identified is that the Democratic progressive establishment likes to put Latinos in neat partitions. You're either Puerto Rican or you're Cuban or you're Mexican. You're either English dominant or you're Spanish dominant, right? And that has a result of creating what I believe are outdated modes of doing outreach to the Latino community. I was around in 2004 when John Kerry taped the very first Spanish language presidential ad. It was the first presidential interview in 2004. It was when we were having to push presidential campaigns to spend time with Univision and Telemundo. Now you see we have Spanish language televised debates on Univision and Telemundo, and that has like evolved. But that is not like most people, and most people my age and those younger than me are not watching Univision and Telemundo to get their news anymore. So now there is a new set of tools and a new set of approaches that we need to be thinking about to, one, better understand the Latino community and who we are today, the Latinx community, and two, spur innovation in new approaches of how we reach this community.
This group, this is it a company? Is it a nonprofit?
We have multiple entities. We have a C4, a C3, and an LLC.
Is it funded out of the same Hoffman type of money?
Some of it is, but it's actually a mix. I think there are institutional folks in Democratic and progressive circles who feel like there needs to be more innovation, who have been I've been in conversation with over the last couple of years, who have said, you know, we need more in this space. And then you also have kind of the disruptive folks from Silicon Valley who also are interested in seeing disruption in the space.
And so what are you trying to build within this organization?
So there are really three threads of the work. The first is around polling, modeling, and analytics. So as I said earlier, a lot of how people view Latinos is dictated by either polling narratives or, and the example I like to use there is Donald Trump about 6 weeks ago tweeted based on an NPR poll that had come out that his support among Latinos had more than doubled. And Latinos, of course, this country wanted the wall. This was at the height of the national emergency and negotiation with Congress around the government shutdown around building the wall.
Are you going to say that he wasn't accurately representing something?
I know that's hard for people to believe, but this is a prime example of where he twisted a fact that was probably not true. When you dig into the numbers of this NPR poll, their survey sample of Latino voters was about 100 Latinos. And if I had to guess, I don't know how they did their poll, but if there was any element of like telephone polling in it, it was probably a conservative Cuban in South Florida or conservative guy in South Texas who picked up their phone and answered this poll, right? Which ultimately, it shaped a narrative, right, about what Latinos care about. And when the establishment sees, oh, well, maybe Latinos do actually support Donald Trump, they move on.
So will you be studying Latino public opinion as part of this?
So one piece is studying Latino public opinion and better understanding what do Latino voters care about across the spectrum. And I think there has never actually been a longitudinal poll of Latinx voters, like on a consistent basis. We'll get shots here and there whenever there's a presidential campaign. They'll like pull the Latino community, do some focus groups for like 6 months. But given the fact that we're not going to have a nominee for a while, like we need to be shaping those narratives now. And the one thing I would just say is better understanding what are the right modes of polling to actually reach Latinx.
So out of curiosity, how are you doing this polling? Because there's so many new innovations going on in how people are assessing public opinion.
Well, so I would say there are a couple layers to this. One, there are a handful of really great pollsters who have been doing good polling in the Latino community, whether that's Latino Decisions or Dr. Gamada out of FIU in South Florida or folks in California like Lisa Garcia Bedoya. There have been a lot of people who have spent time and have real nuanced understanding of particular Latino communities in the U.S. Like the Latinos who live in the Central Valley of California are different than the Latinos who live in Orange County, are different than the Latinos who live in South Texas along the U.S.-Mexico border, are different than those who live in Central Florida, different who live in South Florida. And so there are obviously connections and nuances, but we want to really deeply understand by age, by gender, by number of years in this country, by education, income, where are those subcuts of where those very diverse communities are the same and where they actually different.
Let's say that you're able to get a really good handle on that information, which is obviously changing, but what will you then do with that knowledge?
Yep. So our idea is, one, how do we shape national press narratives around this, right? What Latino voters actually care about in the press and within the establishment of politics. I would also say that it's also really important, and one thing that we are looking at this polling work to do, is how does it inform actual work in the field, right? Research for research's sake is not necessarily helpful unless it is fundamentally being informed by or informing the way that field or the way the kind of scripts that are being developed are
being implemented. So you're going to share this with
as many people as we can.
With as many other Latino organizations.
So that they can take it and implement it in the work that they're doing in the field and running program. Obviously, we've got to kind of figure out all the legal pieces of being able to do that. But I think the ultimate goal is, one, to shape the national narrative, and two, to shape the way that work is actually being implemented in the field. In addition to that, I think it's also really important for us to think about, how do resources and strategy get developed on campaigns? By models, right? And we need sharper, better, more robust modeling of the Latino community. And in my view, again, like, identity or ethnicity models are really important to try to distinguish between a Filipino last name and a Hispanic last name in Las Vegas, Nevada, because a lot of times there's overlap. But at the same time, I believe that identity informs the values that we have, right? And that, you know, one project I really dug deep in this last cycle was the Peoria project that Catalyst did, which was values-based segmentation of the entire electorate. And they basically chopped up the electorate into 12 or 14 different clusters, from the very far left to the very far right and everything in between. I want to better understand, where do Latinos fit in that values-based segmentation, so that, you know, one of the benefits of what digital can do for us is help us hyper-segment and communicate with hyper-local and specific messages to key audiences. And so I think right now, generally speaking, we Democrats and progressives are communicating the same message to the 65-year-old Hispanic male in South Florida as we are the 25-year-old Latinx, transgender, Puerto Rican, Cuban, Afro-Latina in Central Florida. And we are basically saying many of the same things to them, when in reality, they probably have very different value systems. And so how do we both take into account what their identity is as an Afro-Latina Puerto Rican and as a Mexican-American guy, but then overlay the values kind of approach and values-based segmentation to better communicate messages to them?
I always feel a little bit nervous when I hear about how Democrats are targeting, because, yes, as you point out, there's like this infinite mosaic within the Latino community, and then there's lots of other communities. There's an Asian community, there's an African-American community, there's a Jewish community. How do we both maintain a global message that is compelling across the electorate, that we can talk to everybody with, yep, and simultaneously be targeting in that way that is really almost individualized,
yep,
at the end of the day?
Well, and I think that this kind of gets to a lot of what the tension was right after the 2016 election, was like, should we have been focusing more on white working class voters, or should we have been, you know, communicating to African-American and Latino voters in that way? And I was having a conversation with somebody the other day about, if you look at Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Minnesota, there's a growing population of Latino folks in those states. Some of them are immigrants, but a lot of them are not. And you know what? Those people are working class. And you know what? Those people care about having a job, sending their kids to school, the kind of core message and core basis of, like, the Democratic Party around, like, the economy, right? What this values-based approach, I think, just gives us a better way to think about how we communicate. But, like, those meta messages are still the same, right? I think they just give us another layer of how we reach out and communicate more directly with people door-to-door or person-to-person through digital. But the overarching meta narrative, I think, is the same for everybody.
So, like, when you were in the White House and worrying about engagement of this enormous number of Latinos, what do you think you were doing right then, and what were you doing wrong based on what you're thinking about now?
Yeah, I will totally start with the what I was doing wrong, because I've just spent a lot of time thinking about that. One, and President Obama has talked about this publicly, I think this was just not specific to Latinos, but specific to, I think, the entire set of supporters who supported him and the moment in time we had in the country. I don't think we realized that we would literally have to start building from scratch when we went to the White House. Like, we didn't get to carry over his list from the campaign and take that over the White House. In theory, OFA had that, but I think that created some, like, disruptive structure to how we could have been able to, like, keep that energy going. So one of the big challenges was, how did we channel the energy from November 2008 into January, February, March of 2009? And that was really hard to do. And I don't think we did that well.
A lot of people have talked about that on my show and obviously elsewhere. That is so different to campaign than to govern.
Yes. And channeling that energy of people who think like voting in some ways is like the end game, right? It's not actually the beginning of a governing agenda. And so I've spent a lot of time thinking about like in preparation or hopefully in preparation of being back in power in 2021, like how do we more effectively get the groups ready for that moment and that like everybody doesn't go on vacation the day after the election, but is actually pivoting their base and pivoting their groups to and their followers to the governing agenda, right? And how do we maintain that energy? I think the second thing was like the White House was, you know, remember it was 2008. 2008 was the first year like Twitter was actually really, you know, used on a presidential campaign. The Office of Digital Strategy was the first of its kind in a White House. But there were too many silos around how we were communicating. And this is a very tactical thing, but the Office of Digital Strategy and the president's email list lived here. The public engagement lived in a different silo, and we were talking to a different set of people. And then the Office of White House Correspondence like lived in another silo with the millions of people who were writing into President Obama, both by email and by handwritten note. And we were not until after the first reelect in 2012 were we able to kind of try to merge some of those streams.
Do you think it would have been more effective if Obama just tweeted?
You know, and what it did, the, in hindsight, what's so funny is that every tweet he did was super calculated, right? Like every
the
word,
complete opposite,
you know, was run by the counsel's office. It was every T was crossed and every I was dotted before he tweeted anything. And now you see kind of like the ability to do that. You know, I do think like the ability of Donald Trump to be on Twitter to communicate to the masses in that way in a very unvarnished, unapologetic.
Well, it's his ability to do that coupled with the fact that it gets reported on.
I know.
So like everywhere, everybody picks it up. And so it just becomes a gigantic bullhorn.
Yeah, it does. It does. My biggest lessons, I think, were about how we were structurally organized, how we were able to pivot that energy from one to the other. And the third I would just say is you think like when you are going to walk into the White House, there's a certain thing, set of things you're going to be able to do super easily. And I think immigration was one of those that we thought would have been a lot easier to do.
It was so ripe to get it done.
And I think we quickly realized the limits of internal levers of power that we had. I remember where I was and what I was doing when the first big ICE raid happened in February 2009. It was a large-scale worksite raid in Iowa and was just horrible, right? And everything like the
president. So this is your own administration.
Exactly. And that was really the beginning part of it. And I remembered feeling so helpless because I couldn't call ICE and tell them to stop. You know, there are limits because
the wheels are in motion.
The wheels are in motion. And this, to me, in hindsight, was like their big opportunity to say F you to President Obama. Like, we are going to keep doing what we're doing, and we're going to do these large scale work site raids.
You think it was ICE's ability to, you think that was a political statement by that part of the government?
Totally.
Yeah.
I think it was.
Was he pissed?
Yeah. I mean, that was the beginning where we started to realize that ICE was going to be a force that we weren't going to totally be able to manage. And despite every effort to, outside of legislation that President Obama made, to have better prosecutorial discretion or, you know, better enforcement priorities, et cetera, like the people who actually had to implement that had to believe it. And at the end of the day, like there were certain elements within ICE that just were never going to implement that policy from the commander-in-chief in the way that he wanted.
Governing is so many layered.
It is.
Yes. Tell me a little more about ECCIS. So like, how big is it right now? What are your aspirations for it?
Yeah. I mean, we are a very lean team. My co-founder, Carlos Odio, is actually based in Miami. He's Cuban-American from Miami. We both worked on the Obama campaign in 2008 together. The other thread I didn't mention, so polling and modeling is like one really important segment to better understand who is the new Latino electorate. The second piece is how do we spur innovation in tactics? And really from the ground up, how do we ensure that that, you know, if somebody's got a great idea for an online voter registration program in Arizona or in the Central Valley of California, that they are given the room to try and experiment with that to see if they can work and get traction. Right now, you know, these Latino groups who I've worked with for years and years are struggling to survive. I mean, they are in, you know, kind of constant response mode to Donald Trump and don't have a ton of resources to do the kind of organizing they want, and would actively say that they aren't given the kind of room to experiment and fail with new approaches. So that's why they keep doing the tried and true. And
so how can you help them with that?
So what we are planning to do with this digital experimentation program is to do seed grants now in 2019 for new innovative ideas about tackling old problems. So that could be voter registration, it could be ballot education, it could be content creation and distribution, it could be disinformation and stopping disinformation.
Is that ever going to be like just adopt this, like there's ballot ready or there's, you know, there's so many things out there already that are, as you pointed out earlier, not adopted.
Right.
Yeah.
So the idea is to create some of those partnerships, yeah, right? And make sure that Ballot Ready is...
Does that count as innovative in your view?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think not a lot of the traditional Latino orgs or folks are using Ballot Ready right now. And so how do we create and encourage those partnerships? Again, this is like...
Because there are people with a lot of knowledge in specific areas of, yes, how to get turnout up, yeah, or whatever.
Yep. Everybody votes. Vote.org, yeah, you know, on the voter registration side of things, you know, vote.org uses really great, you know, innovative tactics around registering people online. I want them to think about that with the Latino lens and to partner, and because part of this is about building capacity. I don't want vote.org to just do this on their own.
So you see this maybe your group as a connector among other things?
Connector and investor in new ideas. So I talked to somebody the other day who had a really great idea around how to engage Latinos in Iowa in the presidential caucuses. And increased Latino participation in the presidential caucuses would be amazing to see, right? And so if we could help get some seed funding for this small idea and prove that concept, I mean, that concept's going to be harder to prove in June through November of 2019, but, you know, an online voter registration program that we can show there is some traction here. And that way we are then in early 2020 able to give donors and other investors a new menu of opportunities of where they can invest, where we have seen some promising uptake in particular places. But I think it's both the kind of more proven models of like Pulso and Push Black that are doing really, and I don't know if you've interviewed Peter Murray, which you should, or Daryl Scott, who does Push Black. But essentially what they were able to create was through Facebook Messenger, by sending one Black History fact a day, we're able to build a subscriber network of 3.5 million African Americans in this country.
That's amazing.
The NAACP doesn't have that kind of a list. They authentically created this Facebook Messenger subscriber group by sending one Black History fact a day. And when it came time for the election, they were able to activate those people to register and share content virally that went viral right around.
Is there someone doing that in Latino space?
So they have a similar, yeah, one that they are working on called Pulso, which they are working to test and experiment in 2019 with the idea of doing the same piece. Part of one question that we are, you know, talking with Peter about is they're developing this platform and we're going to invest in it, is whether or not you can have a pan-Latino brand. Like, is it possible for that Mexican-American girl in southern New Mexico to be interested in the same content as a woman in Central Florida? That's going to be the question that we're going to have to figure out. My hypothesis is that it depends on the content. And I think like the places where we can, in fact, somebody was saying one piece of content that they shared was the difference between Salvadoran tamales and Mexican tamales, like the differences between. So I think the places where you can actually show that we're similar, but we're different within our own community will help create resonance in a broader pan-Hispanic brand. But again, those are the questions we want to test.
Have you talked to the folks in the Pan-Asian world? Because I know they have the same thing where there's Chinese people and Vietnamese people.
Well, there are greater challenges. They have, yeah, 10 different languages to, yeah, have to, yeah, to work through. I mean, at least we have, for the most part, one common language. Obviously, some folks speak Portuguese. And so they have a much greater challenge in having to communicate with a lot of different people in a lot of different languages.
So what got you excited? Why are you doing this?
It's really two reasons. One, I do think we are at a tipping point in the country of who the country is becoming. I see that Latino voters are growing in their share of numbers, but I still see us being under attack. And obviously, this president has made that a point of his presidency, right, is to attack immigrants, to attack Mexico, and to attack the Mexican-American community in this country. Building power through participation feels just like a really important lever to building power for our community. And people have long talked about the sleeping giant of the Latino community. I wish people would just stop saying that, because what I have come to realize about that analogy is that we're not going to have this one rousing moment where everybody wakes up and one day it's going to be this and one day it's going to be that. It's going to be a slow and steady awakening of this country. We saw this in California and we saw it in Texas in 2018, where the Latino community's participation in both of those places, one in the California congressional districts, I believe helped put many of those districts over the top. But we're voting at greater shares than the 2014 midterm elections, and in some cases, and as in Texas, greater than in 2016. And so you're seeing this like rapidly growing population. And I truly believe that if we do not better understand them as progressives and as Democrats, like we will be set on a path for failure longer term. That is why I feel so passionate about it. And you look at places like Texas and Arizona, which, you know, may or may not be battleground states in 2020. Let's see how the map plays out in some of those places.
Hope Arizona is. Yeah.
Arizona should be. But you look at a place like Texas, and I'm going to look at my numbers here just so that I can get them right. But there are over 3.5 million eligible non-registered Latinos in the state of Texas. So either there, I think there are 1.6 million non-voters and 2 million eligible but not registered voters in the state of Texas. And between now and 2020, there will be 400,000 new Texans who are 17 or 18 years old who will vote in their first election in 2020. Those numbers are astounding. And if
especially when they're larger than the difference between the parties, it's just
precisely.
But it's continually been this notion that if we could just activate these people, we can win these elections. And then election after election, there isn't a right. giant uptick.
Right. And my argument back is that, one, I think we cannot expect Latinos to be a turnout audience. I think there is some level of a conversation that needs to be had. I don't think it's as deep a persuasion audience as certain groups are, but I do think it's a mistaken assumption for people to just throw us into a turnout audience as part of GOTV's strategy. I also think there is a lot to be done in the ballot education space. There was a study done around why that Lisa Garcia Bedoya did out of UC Berkeley, and I'm going to paraphrase this, but essentially Latinos want to feel educated before they go and vote. They don't want to mess up, right? Like they know that this is their one shot. And so if they don't feel like they know what they're actually supposed to go do, they may be too scared to show up. There are also interesting tactics like social pressure that we need to better understand how they affect the Latino community. On social pressure, the fact that like your government stuff is public and your neighbor knows your stuff actually could have backlash in the Latino community, because in places and in families who are mixed status, like you don't want the government knowing who your family is. Just keep your head down. And so social pressure may not be the same kind of social pressure that works for other communities.
Stephanie, you mentioned up top that you have multiple projects going on. What else are you working on?
ECCES is going to be taking up most of my time, because I truly want the major players to invest money better in the Latino community in a smarter way. And I also want to encourage this innovation to be spurred from within the community. I'll continue to spend a little bit of time with Dimitri and Reed on kind of the future of politics. You know, I spend a lot of time also thinking about back in New Mexico and thinking about, well, how do we make New Mexico the next Colorado in terms of economic development and prosperity? We're really lucky that Michelle Lujan Grisham is our newly elected governor there. She's got a lot to do to bring it back from where it's been in the last 8 years under Susana Martinez. But I want New Mexico to be the next Colorado. Like Colorado's bursting at the seams with economic growth and prosperity, and New Mexico should be the next.
And Colorado's moved to a bluish state.
Exactly, yeah. Right. And then the last project I'm working on is our podcast, Finding 46. My co-host Kyle Learman and I were colleagues at the White House together, both worked on the Obama campaign. in 2008. And the podcast is focused on finding the person who will beat Donald Trump and the, answering the question of who can win a Democratic primary, who can actually beat Donald Trump in a general election, and who can be a good president. Are all of those three things the same thing? But we're not interviewing the candidates themselves. We're interviewing the people who are closest to them. So for Julian Castro, we're interviewing his brother, Joaquin, and a reporter who's followed him for the last many years at the San Antonio Express News. Cory Booker, I really want to interview his mother, or Rosario Dawson, who's now his newly reported girlfriend. But we also interviewed a Politico reporter who used to be at the New York Star-Ledger, who followed him for about 10 years. So we're trying to
Where are you so far? Have you launched it? Have you put out some episodes?
We've put out about 6 episodes. The first 4 episodes where we actually did deep dives in the first 4 primary states. So we interviewed Paul Tews, who ran Obama's campaign in Iowa. We interviewed the state party chair for the New Hampshire and Nevada Democratic parties. And in South Carolina, we interviewed Jamie Harrison, who's now running for Senate against Lindsey Graham, but is a former Democratic Party chair down there, to give a flavor of how are these states all different? What are voters going to be looking for? What are like the key places, you know, presidential candidates need to go to talk to voters? Where should they not miss?
So what have you learned so far? It seems like a tremendous topic. I'm always envious when people have better topics.
Well, we'll have to have you on the podcast. And part because we want to have other people in addition to these candidate interviews that we're going to be doing, people who understand the process of running a presidential campaign, both from the campaign hard side and the actual institutions of a presidential campaign and machinations within that, but then also what happens on the independent side and kind of how that plays into that.
What are you hearing so far about what candidates?
It's amazing because obviously everything is changing in such real time. There's a general consensus that, and even if you think about back in where December we were with who was projected to run for president, you had people like Terry McAuliffe and Mitch Landrieu and a number of folks who had really strong governing records, but weren't necessarily, didn't have like a core constituency, let's say. And so with Joe Biden likely getting in, I think he has cleared the field with, you know, Sherrod Brown not in the race. I think in those three in particular are not in the race because Joe Biden is likely to get in, right? And so
because they're ideologically not too far from him.
They're not too far from him, yeah.
And he's been vice president and they were governors. And,
yeah, exactly. So I think that's an interesting dynamic to just see how even over the last 3 months we have seen the field shift dramatically. So I think like that will be an interesting thing. I think that the question though around is the person who can win the Democratic primary, the person who can actually beat Trump and actually be a good president. That is the challenge. I don't have a great answer to that yet.
And it's a really crazy process in so many ways where in the order of the states, in the way that people finance, in the notion that what candidates enter affect who splits what part of the vote.
Exactly.
And so you could rerun this same thing with different rules and a different schedule and get different results.
Totally. You could actually see the first 4 primary states having 4 different winners. You could see somebody winning in Iowa that's different than who wins in New Hampshire, who wins in South Carolina, who wins in Nevada. And then meanwhile, now that California is moving their dates up, like when people can submit ballots, you will have people voting in California at the same time some of these primaries will be going on. And I think what is interesting about this race is that now, you know, if you go back to 2008 and 2012, Obama obviously won Iowa in 2008, lost New Hampshire, was behind in South Carolina, but actually ended up winning South Carolina and eventually Nevada. And then Hillary Clinton, the same in South Carolina, was kind of her game changer, right? Black voters came out to support her in South Carolina. It was kind of very clear in those places where, you know, the South and Nevada actually played kind of a disruptive role for the race, right? But now you see no one candidate has a complete block who is supporting them. You have 2 black candidates in the race, right? Like you have multiple women. You have Cory Booker, Kamala Harris. You have multiple women in the race. There's no kind of core geographic.
There's multiple progressives. There's multiple.
So how this kind of slices and dices is going to be really interesting. And I think people like Julian Castro, with Joaquin Castro getting in the Senate race to run against John Cornyn, 2 Castros on the ticket in Texas, could have an also a really interesting that nobody's really talking about. And even with a Beto on the ticket, like, going to give him a run for his money in his home state, right? Like, when you have two Castro brothers who look exactly the same, who basically, like, there should be election rules about that. But now, you know, we're going to give Beto a run for his money in his home state.
Do you have a personal angle on this?
I don't. And what's interesting to me is now I have friends who literally work on basically all of these campaigns. I know many of the candidates myself. But part of what Finding 46 is about is my own personal journey of trying to figure out who I want.
I feel like I'm on that journey too.
I think everybody is. Yeah. And so, or most people.
Most Democrats are right now.
Most Democrats are trying to just like suss out.
We really want to win this one.
We do. And so the question is, winning the same, who can win, going to be the person who makes us feel good? Is it going to be the same person who we feel like can run the best campaign? How much is actually running a good campaign?
Do we want someone who has a lot of experience governing, who won't be as inept at it as the current incumbent? Do we want someone who's a really good campaigner because that's such a vital part of it? Do we want someone who's ideologically close to us? Do we want someone who looks like us?
Exactly. Yeah. And so all of those things together, I think there are a couple key pieces that I think are going to be important. I think running a good, solid campaign matters. It matters like finding the right ways to channel your volunteer and supporter capacity into real action is going to be critical, right? So like finding the person who can actually do that and with on a shoestring, because we know all of these candidates are going to have limited resources because there's so many people to give to and donors don't want to be committing their money either.
There's some that are guaranteed to have a fair amount of resources too.
Right. Bernie, yeah. Beto, who have managed to, who
probably
have
Biden
yeah. who have like really, and maybe even Kamala too. Mm-hmm. But I think people who can build really solid structures and really solid organizing structures.
What kind of questions are you asking? Like, clearly, if you're talking to people who are close to the candidate who've been around them, you'll have to come across topics like Klobuchar and how she treats her staff or just how people are as managers.
Yep. Leadership is a key piece. And I think that is one thing that we are kind of seeing over time is one record, I would say, and leadership. So these are the people and partly why, you know, we're interviewing people who are like personally close with them, like family members, spouses, siblings, et cetera. And then also reporters who have a more agnostic view of them and can actually be a check on what their record is. So part of like what I learned about Cory Booker with David Giambuso, who's now the City Hall reporter in New York City for Politico, is, you know, he's kind of been the same guy. And like, he is a workhorse. Like, and that is the thing that he said that has not changed about him at all is like his work ethic. And he literally almost knocked every door in Newark.
Did you happen to watch the movie, the documentary about his first run?
Yeah, I remember
seeing that in the theater in Cambridge years, just when it came out. And he lost his first campaign for mayor against Sharp James. But he showed a star quality already.
Exactly. Yeah. And the work ethic. I mean, he really did almost knock on every door in Newark.
People who are close to him, when I've interviewed them, have just said he's a good person. Like, he will go out of his way for anybody.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I hosted an event with him probably like 6 months ago, and he literally waited until he talked to every single person who attended that event.
Which could be good or bad.
But the amount of energy that he has and is committed to doing that. And so I think, you know, he really wants that person-to-person connection. I do think one thread that we're seeing with all of the candidates, Cory Booker called this like sibling rivalry between them, is that they can hold each other accountable and push each other, but do it in a respectful way. Because I think what we want to also just see and what I think voters want to see just better civil discourse. We have to think about like Trump, and I don't know if you saw the episode of The Circus last night.
No, I did not.
You should, but because they interviewed Steve Bannon, who, you know, I'm like, you know, Steve Bannon is the X factor in Republican politics. It sounds like he's most scared of Beto, and he also thinks Nancy Pelosi's been doing a really great job. And so when we can kind of get under Steve Bannon's skin and kind of see where he is.
Well, I think I've always thought that one of the best ways to look at politics is to think about who the other side doesn't want to run against. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think we do a good job as Democrats of seeing that and of seeing particularly why there's a bunch of fairly moderate Democrats that won the close seats in the House because they fit their districts. But if you're a Republican, who do you want to run against?
Yep.
Who do we not want to run against?
Yep.
We don't want to run against a reasonable Republican governor like they had in Maryland or Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. We lose to them. We want to run against someone from the right wing, generally.
Yep, exactly. And I think them being able to very quickly be able to turn out the very excitable, you know, super right wing base, how much more do we need to turn out our base and find new voters to beat that enthusiasm and the like shrinking middle that exists also?
I'll tell you one thing that I want to see from a candidate.
Yeah.
A willingness to take on some of the conventional wisdom that sits on the progressive side on a variety of issues.
Yep, I agree. Yeah. And I think you are seeing some of that. I think even just the kind of policy issues we're talking about in some ways, like challenging that conventional wisdom of what we can talk about, how we talk about it.
Or being willing to challenge some of the interest groups on our side.
Like, exactly.
Because one of the things that Trump did as a candidate that, because he's so headstrong and because he's so sure of himself, even if he's wrong about most things, he was able to change his party's platform dramatically. And in some cases, to his benefit, like on trade, I think really found a part of the electorate that helped him, probably on immigration too. Whereas he never, if he was more of a regular Republican, he never could have done that. And is there someone on our side who has that strategic sense?
Yeah. Oh, 100% agree with that. And what's interesting on the trade conversation, because I did work on that debate while I was at Commerce in the White House on TPA. And, you know, it was interesting in the polling that we saw internally between, you know, there's conventional wisdom that like Democrats don't like trade and Republicans are pro-trade, right? And I think it's wrong too, because you actually see there was broad-based Democratic support for it. And that was, I guess, in 2014, so this was pre-Trump, we started seeing fissures on the right on trade back then. And I remember saying, like, don't tell Republican members of Congress who we need to like pass.
Well, there's
this
fissures on both sides. Yeah. That's why it was an interesting issue.
Right. But there were more fissures on the Republican side because everybody just thought all Republicans are for pro-trade. Right. And in reality, they weren't. And we saw that in 2014. That obviously materialized in, I think, how that electorate rallied around Trump. But I think you're right. The people who have that strategic sense. I also think, like, coming back to the Latino piece, like, Republicans are really smart about where they go try to attack the margins. And Florida has always been the case in my lifetime, has always come down to like less than 100,000 votes, right? Like, it is always a nail biter.
It's a painful state.
It's a painful state with so many different cuts, right? But what Republicans are really smart in doing now is two parts of the Latino electorate, three parts really. One are obviously Cubans, but Venezuelans. There is a reason that Donald Trump is being so outspoken on Venezuela, why Marco Rubio is going to the Colombia-Venezuelan border, and why Mike Pence is spending a ton of time in Florida with the Venezuelan community. It's not a big community, but is big enough to matter to a margin of victory, that if they can say Donald Trump was their savior in this moment of crisis for their home country. The second is evangelical Christians, Hispanic evangelical Christians. Republicans know that is like a large growing slice of the electorate in Central Florida, and so they are spending a lot of time and resources cultivating those relationships on social issues. And then the third is the Puerto Rican community. The reason that, in my view, that Bill Nelson lost the Senate seat in Florida was because Rick Scott, as governor, when you would land at the Orlando airport from Puerto Rico, there was a sign that said, "Bienvenidos to Florida. We are welcome to have you here," with a picture of Rick Scott. And he did his campaign launch in Central Florida in a predominantly Puerto Rican neighborhood with very important key leaders from political leadership from the island that sent the signal to the Puerto Rican community, hey, I'm your guy. Despite like what a corrupt politician we think him to be and their long-term record on the island and the issues related to Puerto Rico and Hispanics, like, they knew. And Republicans are running ads in Florida targeting Venezuelans and Cubans today in 2019, a year before the presidential election.
So is part of what you're trying to do with your group to counter these moves?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. In these key places where there were key marginal populations.
Is there a question I should have asked you that I failed to?
Oh, wow. I don't think so. I think we covered the waterfront.
Well, I'm confident we could talk all day. and I'd love to hear more of your opinions on things, but I better be respectful of your time.
Thank you.
So anything else you want to say?
I'm just really excited, one, to be on this podcast, and two, for the possibilities that will exist and await us in 2020. And I think the things that I worry about heading into 2020 are really ones that I think we have time to still fix and address. And so I hope that we can do that and beat Donald Trump.
And I'm glad that you're in the fight.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. That was Stephanie Valencia with Equis. I look forward to seeing how her new organization develops and listening to her new podcast, Finding 46. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com. or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.